Or pay me to in beaver pelts. Decolonial. Have a lovely day.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Good morning, my name is Catherine. I'm the events executive here at CITR, and this program is for 24 hours of student power. On Thursday, I had the opportunity to interview Bryn Lacroix and Yvonne Zhao from UBC Players Club, as well as the opportunity to interview Jordy Matheson. What follows for the next hour on the program will be my interview with Bryn and Yvonne, as well as the interview with Jordy.
So my name is Bryn. I'm the president of the club. I'm third year BA theater. And I'll let you, Yvonne, introduce yourself. Yes.
My name is Yvonne. I'm in my fourth year studying international relations and creative writing.
And what is UBC Players Club?
So we're a resource for students to be involved in theater when they don't have an opportunity anywhere else.
Yeah, so we're the on-campus theater club. We give opportunities to people to be involved as playwrights, directors, actors, all things theater.
How did the club get started?
So it was in 1915. It was actually one of the first theater groups in BC, and it was the first club on campus. It started a few weeks after we opened, and it developed out of the English department by one of the professors.
When was that, approximately?
It was September 1915.
September 1915?
Yeah.
Oh, that's really old. So from what I understand from your website, the UBC Players was disbanded around the 70s. I think that was about the time that the theater department opened, but then you reopened in 2000. Was there a new mandate or a new goal when you started, a way to make it more sustainable?
Yeah, so what happened was the program started, and it before the Players Club was a really big deal. They used to operate pretty much as a professional company. They would travel, and they were really well-known internationally. And then all our key members, you'll know them, like Dorothy Somerset, we have her studio, we perform them every year. Frederick Wood, we perform in his theater. They were all founding members of our club, and then they went on to develop the theater program at UBC. So we took a step back so they could get established, and then we felt in the early 2000s it was time to bring the club back. And instead of it being this kind of pretentious, really like special thing, we made it more of a club that was more accessible to everybody, since the BFA can feel really inclusive, and it can be exclusive, and it can be hard to find opportunities to do theater. So we became a place where anyone could really join or start out or learn those like foundational skills.
Is that your goal, to provide an entrance into theater for
yes.
students?
Yes. We have a few mottos. We have theater on your own terms. So just meaning that you can make anything you want to here. There's no strict guidelines or rules. And if you have no experience, but you're like, I really want to direct, this is the place you can come to, and we can help you figure that role out.
Would you say that that's what makes you unique on campus as well?
I would say so, because if you want to get involved with the shows through the department, you have to either A, be a BFA student, or a BA student who's like kind of sneaks your way in there. And it's really hard to get involved any other way. Or you have to work professionally, like off campus. So this is kind of a place for one of the few clubs on campus that provides you with that professional mentality. That's what we try our best to run our club like a professional theater company. Yeah. The best of my ability, I try.
And a lot of our alum end up going off and graduating and working in theater in Vancouver and around.
We have quite a few success stories. And that's how a lot of people get their start, is networking, because someone comes to like some event. Like I was in a show recently, and one of the directors was like, oh, my piece was produced in like 2010, blah, blah, and that helped me get my start and like things like that. So it's really cool.
Yeah, that is really cool. So from what I've read on your website, there's the student leadership body in UBC Players Club. I think it's student executive. Is that right?
Yes. So we have me as the president, and then we have Ivana's treasurer. And then we have different teams. So we have our VP of events, and he has his executives, and they run all our monthly events. And then we have our production team, and we have two PNMs this year, so production managers. And then they have people on their production team, and then we hire externally for all our shows. And then we have our promotions team. We have a VP there, and then she has her execs. And then I kind of like overlook everything, and it works really well.
And so you're all students?
Yes, yes.
Are most people in arts, sciences? Is it a mix?
It's a pretty broad mix, actually. The presidents before me were in arts, but the ones before that was in science. And we have like quite a large variety of people, because a lot of kids who go into like engineering or science, and then they don't get to do any theater classes or anything right. like that. So they love coming to us so they can do it on the side.
What do you think that having a student leadership body in the club brings to the club?
I think it's really interesting how we get to vote on everything. We get to hear everyone's opinions, so it's not like someone's overseeing, like it's not like a real adult overseeing us, and gets to like dictate our actions. And if we make a mistake, then we have to figure it out, and we're kind of on our own.
That's also just a really good experience and a really good place for people to grow their leadership skills. I know last year I was production manager, and it was a really big challenge and a big role for me to fill, but I learned a lot in that position. So it's just a really good opportunity for people to not only get involved in theater, but just learn how to be a leader.
Yeah. So following on that personal note, what has your involvement in UBC Players Club brought to each of your personal experience at UBC? How has that influenced your undergraduate degree?
So much for me.
So much. Yeah. For both of us, I ended up being president in my second year, and I was our youngest president we've ever had.
Because
we usually recommend that you're like either a third or fourth year student. And it was one of those things where if I didn't take the club over, there really wasn't anyone else. And for a while there, they thought the club was going to have to end. They were like, no one could take it over. And they were like, Brent's going to do it. And then Yvonne was the same. She didn't have too much experience in like that field. So yeah. Both of us were kind of dropped in the deep end, and we had to figure out how to swim together. And that's how we became so close. I think we definitely learned a lot of skills, like really good at crisis management now. And definitely, I think we really grew into the roles now, because now that I'm president still, and now that she has a different role, I think we definitely know how to handle ourselves different now. Mm-hmm. And we know how to manage situations differently. Like, it really taught us how to like work on our feet and figure out what was going on.
Yeah. And also just on a personal note, like I've made my best friends from the club, and it's just been a really awesome bonding experience every time we do a show together.
Yeah, they're good people. And what's really interesting is because we hire externally for like all our productions, so you have a whole new group of people coming every time. So it's not like the same eight people sitting in a room putting on the same boring production every year. Yeah. You get this huge like mix of people, so you're always meeting new people, and it's so great. Like, we see our stage manager for this show and our like PM, they're like best friends now, and we didn't even know they knew each other like a little while ago. So it's really cool how you see those relationships develop.
Yeah, that is really great. So as a club as a whole, how do you choose what plays to put on? Who actually is in charge of that decision?
We have a voting process, so it's like a little bit confusing, but we operate pretty similarly for both our shows. We put out a call and we get all the applications in, and then the entire exec team, all of us, all the VPs, have to read all the scripts and all the applications.
Wow.
And then we sit down and we have a discussion about them. And if anyone from our club applies, we like blank all the names and all, like we blank everything. So you just see like credentials and like what they want to do. And then we discuss it and any like problems we have, anything we're really excited about, and then we vote, and whoever gets the most votes wins.
About how many entries do you get?
It depends.
Last year we had, I think, around 17 for main stage, which was record breaking for us.
Yeah. And then for Dionysia we had quite a few, because our application is kind of complicated for Dionysia, so we had a record-breaking amount for that, too. We had upwards of 20-something.
Yeah, 20-something, for sure.
For the main stage production, are they original plays, or are they all classics that will be adapted?
We ask people to apply with a show that's already been published, just because Dionysia, for us, is all about student-written plays, and then we get dramaturges and we get people involved to help edit their work, so it's really good, but we don't have the time for that exactly for our main stage, and we do like to stick with the classics. Like, we did Disgrace 2 years ago, and we did Doubt last year, and then we did Ghost this year. We do like to stick with that kind of dark fall theme.
That's really great. So Ghosts, as you've just mentioned, is happening right now, literally as we speak. So earlier on today, I had a chance to interview the director of Ghosts, Jordi, who I guess you selected out of this process to bring Ghosts to UBC Players Club and to direct it. I saw the play on Tuesday, and it was very successful. And so here's my interview with Jordi discussing the play, how he chose it, and his opinions on how it went. Just for listeners who haven't seen Ghosts, can you give a brief overview of the background of Ghosts and then also the context of when it was written and who Henrik Ibsen was?
Certainly. So it was written in the 1890s by a playwright named Henrik Ibsen, as you mentioned, and he was a famous Norwegian playwright. He has written in many, many different styles, but the style which he is most remembered for is termed realism. He was a part of the realist movement in European theater in the late 19th century, which involved himself, Strindberg, and Chekhov a bit later on, as well as many other folks, including directors and others. And he wrote about four or five plays that are considered his great realist masterworks, including A Doll's House, including The Wild Duck, and as well as Ghosts. Mm-hmm. And so Ghosts is sort of right in the middle of this period. It was the play he did after Doll's House, which was a huge, huge success, as well as a bit of a scandal for the themes that it had and the way that it dealt with those themes. And Ghosts was almost that sophomore thing where the first in albums, you know, the first album has its themes and its style and its musical tones, and then the second album will just kind of like go big on all of those themes, and Ghosts is sort of that. So Ghosts is about a family, the Alving family, and the father figure, Captain Alving, has passed away a few years before. And so there is this house which is being built in his dedication, an orphanage, which is being built in his dedication because he was a famous captain in Norway. And what we find out through the course of the play is that his legacy is a bit more messy than we'd like to hope, and there's a lot of discussion of the difference between ideals and truth and what is more valuable, and all of this is around the lead character of Helen Alving, who is Captain Alving's Captain Alving's widow, who has carried a lot of these secrets of his past, and now is seeing the ways that those secrets have started resonating around her and to the next generation in these unexpected and unwanted ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you know what contributed to the decision to play Ghosts at the Playhouse?
So they do the Players Club does a call for submission for a director for their main stage show, and that director present a proposal for a production that they'd be interested in doing. And I talked to Bryn, the president of the UBC Players mm-hmm. Club, and I was like, what kind of shows do you folks like mm-hmm. to do before I did my proposal? And she was like, well, we usually do classics, and we do, and besides that, it's pretty broad. She mentioned that it would be nice maybe to do a show that is royalty-free because they haven't done like a classic work in a long, long time. And it also is just releases a little bit of the financial tension to put money into other things. So I was like, cool. And so I went away and I reflected on that. And I had read Ghosts a little while before, not even in a class. I know it's often done in a study setting, but I thought it was beautiful and really fascinating and tragic and terribly contemporary in its issues. So I wrote up a little proposal for that, and that's how it came to be.
Great. What are some of the challenges of putting on a play that takes place in a different century and such a different context than what we're living in now?
Yeah, I think one of the main struggles I had was what interests me most about this play is not time period or the setting. And I'm sure there's other directors who are like, it needs to be, the specificity is what makes this play great. But for me, I wanted to sort of release that sense of it being a period piece. So the language still retained a lot of that old-fashioned quality, just by virtue of it being a royalty-free English translation, which was like 120 years old. But a lot of my other choices I made in how I directed the actors, in costume and set, in all of that sort of stuff, was to strip away as many signifiers of time period. So I removed some of the objects that are very indicative of a specific time period. Mrs. Alving wears pants. Nobody's wearing top hats. Nobody's in like long frilly dresses. The bottles that they have labels on them. Just all these choices to make it more feel like as you're watching it, you can't quite pin down when it's supposed to be taking place. Because I think that's a very important question to have as a viewer of this play when considering the themes, because I think the themes, a strong aspect of them is that these feelings of suppression, these feelings that the culture is against you, are just as salient now as they were 100 years ago. And so my big fear, or the reason I didn't have it be more specific to the time period, was because then audiences could watch it and be like, oh, well, that was then and this is now and we don't need to. And that's a very nice, you know, period drama, but it's, I didn't want it to put it into the same realm of like a fluffy period piece. I wanted it to be more focused on the characters and the themes of those characters' relationships to each other. I don't know if that answers the question you were asking.
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
I think so. So you're talking about those themes as being suppression and the relationships between the characters. Why did you choose to focus on those themes and to choose a play that focuses on those themes now in this social setting? Was it to do with 2018 or just life as human nature is?
Yeah, I think it's... when I chose the play, I was most fascinated by the characters, the strength of, like, these characters have such strong needs and wants, and as an actor, that's a really important thing to have, because that really helps an actor in playing a character and get digging into a character, and also it helps with an audience to dig into a story. So I liked that it had such a strong structure and such a strong backbone of character, and it was only after I started rereading it and started, I did some like very light editing of the language, because the 120-year-old English translation had a lot of very sort of anachronistic uses of words that just kind of took me out more than they engaged me. And people do that all the time with translations of just contemporizing the language. So as I was doing that, as I was doing that sort of little a light edit, I really started noticing that these characters are also carrying these broader themes of duty and ideals and the difference between those and the conflict between social structures and individual freedom and sort of how social mores may cause people more suffering than they cause happiness. So yeah, I don't think I had like a specific like, oh, these themes really resonate with the climate, mm-hmm. As much as I discovered that. And I think all great theater will in some way be able to resonate with the present moment, whatever the present moment might be. That's why they retain that importance over time. So I think it's not that Ghost is 100% the perfect play for this moment as much as the themes that it carries are valuable for any time.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I noticed that the play had quite a strong female presence, I think especially because the protagonist of the play is female, and mm-hmm. also because you cast a female to play the father.
Engstrand.
Was that intentional, or did it just happen as you were directing the play?
Yeah. It definitely was something that happened early on in casting. We have so many amazing female actors audition, mm-hmm. and I was like, oh, I want all of these people to be in the play, but there's only two female characters, and at the same time, like, our male actors that we have are fantastic, mm-hmm. But we did have less actors on a whole, a smaller pool of actors audition, and for a little while I was like, why don't I just do like an all-female version of the play? And yeah, I went back and forth on that for a little while, because I thought that would have been interesting, and perhaps I will do, and I said once I decided that I wasn't going to do that, I was like, I'm going to do that at some point in the future, because I think that would be really cool. In the end, I just picked the people I felt were best for the role, and tried to be as gender and et cetera blind as possible, or not blind, mm-hmm. I apologize. That's an ableist term. But I tried to be as open to as many different varieties of casting as possible, and it just happened that Valley did a really excellent audition, and I wasn't immediately like, oh, she's perfect for Engstrand. But I was like, I think what she would bring to Engstrand would make it a more dynamic character than somebody who just played him as a villain.
Right.
Like, she's a really friendly, kind person.
Yes.
In person. And also, his language is the most, that's her accent. She has that accent in real life.
Oh, interesting.
So I didn't want anybody putting on accents, but I really felt that Engstrand's character loses something if he doesn't have a certain quality to his voice, and I think her just natural accent played well with the text as it was written.
So you mentioned earlier that you did not stick to Ibsen's stage directions and very precise details.
No.
And I think especially at the beginning of the play, there's the moment, the very opening scene when the protagonist walks onto the stage in the dark and is breathing and the lights are changing as she breathes.
Yeah.
Am I right in saying that was your direction?
Yeah, that's not in the original. No, they wouldn't have had the stagecraft, which is wild because, you know, it's a micro-budget production. But they wouldn't have had the ability to, like, so specifically, like, raise and lower lights in the original production. No. And again, he's a realist, so that's a very sort of theatrical element.
Yeah, so. And even her breathing and all that, I think at the closing as well, there was a lot of drama and theatrical elements that you mm-hmm. added to it. What inspired that decision, that sort of shift from the realist to the maybe even surrealist?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it was surreal, maybe expressionistic, because I was trying to express the inner world of these characters in the external. And my main reason for that is because I thought it would look fun and cool. And I was just aware that I knew that I was going to have this production team, and I wanted to give them interesting things to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I just loved the idea of having these lamps, because the lamplight is the most realistic light. Like, stage light is such a fake, unnaturalistic light. And yeah. So there's just, whenever I see a play that's like a realist play, like a realist drama, but it's lit by perfect washes of light, I find that very like they're not committing to the realism of this world. So I didn't have this language at the beginning of the production, but I found this lovely quote talking about the difference between Bertolt Brecht and Stanislavski, who are both famous directors of theater, and one is known as like the great director of naturalistic realistic drama, and the other is known as kind of doing this big non-realistic epic theater. But this quote was arguing that actually both of them are 100% committed to realism. One, Stanislavski, is committed to emotional realism, like the actors fully embodying their character, so it seems like you are just watching real people experiencing mm-hmm. the world in real time, and it's a total, you're transported into their world. As where Bertolt Brecht is, as any, you know, student who has taken a theater class, I'm not saying anything that's super dense or unheard of, but he focuses on realism of the fact that we are all in a theater together. You are people who are in a political circumstance. We are also people in the same political circumstance. And for us to just pretend that none of that is existing is not real, is untrue. So I think a lot of the choices I made was like acknowledging that I tried to have a little bit of both somehow. So like the actors themselves are performing genuine and real and true, and I'm not, you know, doing any winks or nudges in the performance, but I wanted the audience to be aware that this performance is taking place in a theater space and is not a real space, that these are actors coming into this space and creating that world, because I think that's more cool, like when you're mm-hmm. allowed in to see the seams a little bit, to see that they're actors, and then when they become the characters, and when just a bunch of like chairs and carpets become like a room, I think that's magical. Yeah. So yeah, I think a part of the magic of theater is the going back and forth between emotional realism and flights of theatrical magic or theatricality, and just having one or the other is less interesting to me than having a little bit of both. So mm-hmm. I think that's why I weave in and out. Like most of the actual acting and scenes that the characters have together are played straight, and then there are moments where I allow for more expressionistic aspects to come in. Because I think that also brings the audience back in as well, because you're like, yeah. This is a realistic play. Now these lamps that I thought were just stage props are doing this thing that I didn't expect them to do. And that keeps the audience, I hope, keeps the audience asking what's going to happen next, and removes them from their expectations of what a realist play will be. Yeah.
And picking up on what you were saying about space and how that influences the way that the audience interacts with the play mm-hmm. and experiences the play, I think as soon as I walked into the theater, the first thing that I noticed was that the chairs were arranged in almost a semicircle around the stage. Was that your decision? Was that something you were trying to...
Yeah, that was my decision as well off the top. And again, it was just this want for there to be less distancing. So being aware, yes, we're in a theater, these people are our actors, but you're not somewhere else, you're here, and these actors are here, like right here. And I think the closer you can get to performers and the less you'd have, and if you don't have it in like a proscenium style where it could be just like you could get like a screen and project it and it be a play on a film and it would be the mm-hmm. same thing, like breaking it up, having it in a different configuration, having the actors so close again just destabilizes your expectations of what it will be. And then also something that people. I wish I could think of a specific quote, but that I've learned and discussed with my peers and teachers is just like, one of the great things about going to live theater is actually being able to see the person across the way mm-hmm. and see them experiencing what you're experiencing. Because we're so often, like when you see a film in a theater, there is that, but it's not acknowledged. And mm-hmm. And it's almost as if you're alone watching that thing. But I really wanted it to be like a communal experience of watching these people in this, yeah, that you are just as much a part of this theatrical space as they are. It's not that there's the actors here and the audience here. It's like it's the actor, audience, theater space. And that's partially why I also have the actors sitting in the space as well, because yeah. they're not leaving the space. They don't get a special privilege that you don't have, or like go off somewhere that you don't see. They're there the whole time, and you're there with them. And yeah, I think it just makes it more intimate.
Mm-hmm. How do you think that intimacy affects the way that the audience members reflect on the play as they leave and carry it with them?
Oh, I don't know. I'd have to ask them. I'm not sure about that one. My hope is that it allows for the, all these choices I made were not to get in the way of the story, but mm-hmm. to heighten the impact of the story. And sometimes that meant diverging from realism. Sometimes that meant destabilizing the space a little bit. But it was all in the hopes that when they leave, they feel like, oh, I really connected with this story. I really strongly felt for these characters. And I also felt like I was 100% seeing a play. I was not seeing a movie. I wasn't mm-hmm. seeing, I wasn't listening to a podcast. I wasn't doing, like, this was a specifically theatrical experience mm-hmm. that I wouldn't have had this experience had I watched this play on film.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is different. So since this play does take place centuries previously, there are a lot of aspects to it, such as the discussions about insurance and social mm-hmm. Social expectations that are no longer expected in our society that might maybe feel archaic if you're reading on the script, but when live and performed were actually very compelling and dynamic. How do you suspend the tension and interest over long scenes of very personal and social discussions?
Yeah. I think that's something that in the end that's the actor's domain, at least for this play, and because they have to carry so much weight, like yeah. they have so much language to untie. So if I was like trying to add too much directorial manipulation, like being too specific with the blocking or trying to be too constraining with their choices, then it wouldn't be organic. So like I try to make sure that always there is, even when they're talking about fairly pedantic, uninteresting, on the surface things, that the characters have a real strong want. Like, what do they, at every moment, they want something from somebody, or they want something for themselves that person can give them, figuring out what that is and playing that and really and just being strong on that, so it's not just scenes of people, so it's not just talking.
Mm-hmm.
That the talking is sort of the tip of the iceberg, and then there's the way their bodies are moving in the space, the way they look at each other, the intonation, like all the, you know, all the stuff that is acting can maybe even imply an opposite thing. They might be saying like, I hate you, but their body is expressing that they're in love with that person.
Yeah.
And I think really emphasizing the irony of what they're saying. A lot of the times the characters are almost saying the opposite of what they mean or what they want, which has 100% to do with the fact that this is a play about restraint, the constraining qualities of that society can place on people. But yeah, just allowing them to really play that, and hopefully that strongly, again, will connect for an audience, hopefully. Yeah.
Yeah. And as we've mentioned, that this play is a tragedy, and it deals with restraint, and then it also deals with illness and suicide and mm-hmm. a lot of violence. Mm-hmm. What are the challenges?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Forgot about that. That too. What are the challenges of directing such a really emotionally hard and draining play?
So something I really worked on, and I think it's hard in a small space, like when, because the night you went, it was a fairly small audience.
Yeah.
But we really worked on what are the moments of levity? What are the moments of compassion and warmth in the play? What are the moments of genuine kindness? And when are characters making jokes and mm-hmm. et cetera? Like just all those things that people do in real life all the time. And in a play like this, when you're like, oh, it's a tragedy, it's miserable, we'll kind of get, could get forgotten or not paid attention to because it doesn't correlate with our expectation of the play. So in the rehearsals, we'd like be fully willing to be like, oh, this is like a funny moment, or this is a funny line, and allow that to be, and be like, okay, how, let's not underappreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
And then as far as the actual rehearsal period, I tried to make sure that it was, that we allowed for laughter a lot of the time, like just outside of like the rehearsal space, tried to keep the rehearsal space as light and fun and silly as possible, so that we could come out of the kind of dark stuff that the play mm-hmm. works with, and I think that helped it not be as draining as it could have been on the actors. I mean, it's still draining. It's such a hard amount, so much work in such a short period of time,
mm-hmm.
but not hopefully dreading going to the rehearsal space because it's going to be like too intense. And I'm sure there's actors who like, they'd love that. That's their, they have the fortitude for that. But I was happy with the way we ran that space. We managed that space.
Yeah, definitely. And what's next for you now that Ghosts is on its way?
Finishing the semester, writing essays that I've been holding off on. As far as theater-related things, in the early fall, I will be helping out with a sort of interdisciplinary, it's called The Human Library,
mm-hmm.
and it is a storytelling event. It's a very intimate storytelling event where it's one person telling a story to another person, and we have about 10 to 12 storytellers, and they'll tell their story for about 30 minutes to one person at a time.
Wow.
And their personal stories from their life, we call them our human books, because each person has a story to tell.
Yeah.
And we're actually in our submission period, so if I can plug for that, if anybody's listening and they want to be involved with the Human Library, they think they have a personal story from their life experience that they want to tell, feel free to email at Jordy, Jordy, Matheson, Matheson, 94, at gmail.com. JordyMatheson94@gmail.com. If you're interested in taking part in the Human Library, that's coming up in February. And then I'm also working on a project called Sex, Lies, and Citizenship.
Is that for theater?
It is a theater production we're expecting. I don't know how much I'm allowed to. It's a more broad... there's a bunch of people working on it. And I don't know how much we're supposed to talk about it beforehand, because it's coming up in May, so we still have some time, but that's another thing that I'm working on, and it's going to be a collaborative performance wow. piece.
So is it
original production? Yeah. I mean, it's not my, I didn't spearhead it. It was started by a master student at UBC who has moved on to get her PhD in Toronto, and she sort of passed the role of doing the show to a cohort of other folks to pick up the mantle and bring it to completion.
It's exciting.
So that's super exciting. And I'm in an improv show on Monday.
Wow.
Queerprov. You can check them out at Queerprov on Facebook. And they do shows every Monday, and I'll be on the show on Monday. Yeah.
It's a lot going on.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You know what's better than reading a great magazine? Reading a great magazine that also helps you fight poverty. Megaphone Magazine is sold by homeless and low-income vendors on the streets of Vancouver and Victoria. Vendors buy magazines for 75 cents and sell them for $2. It's flexible, low-barrier work for people who may not have access to traditional jobs. Download the Megaphone app to find vendors and buy the magazine, even when you don't have change.
Thousands of opinions are at our fingertips. But are all opinions informed? Does your information have a source? Is your social feed based on fact? Only facts can uncover the truth. Professional journalists are committed to balanced and nonpartisan reporting, to independent commentary. They cut through the spin to give you the information and perspective you need. Journalism is essential to democracy, a watchdog over the powerful, an independent voice. Journalism is more important than ever.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
To CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Catherine, the events executive at CITR, and this program is for 24 hours of student power. You just heard my interview with Jordy Matheson, the director of Ghosts, which just played recently at UBC Players Club. What follows is the remainder of my interview with the UBC Players Club members, Bryn Lacroix and Yvonne Zhao. Ghost was your main stage production that just has happened this fall. And in the spring, you have your next big event, which is Festival Dionysia.
Yes.
Can you explain what that is, what that means?
Yeah, it's something we've been doing for almost a decade. And it is a big one-act festival we do in usually March. So this year it's running the 14th through the 18th in the Dorothy Somerset Studio. And we do a bunch of original one-acts and some published pieces. So it's really interesting to see how students come forward and all the cool work they're producing.
So again, these are students who are not part of BFA, or are they also part of the BFA program?
How it works is our actors can't be BFA. BFA actors can't work in our shows. But we do have BFA production students who are involved, and we do have BFA creative writing students. A lot of MFAs actually apply with their work, which is really cool.
Yeah, it's just nice to see a lot of student work on stage mm-hmm. at once. Yeah, it's a really...
It's so hard to find people who are willing to produce new work. Like, Brave New happens too, which is really cool. But we don't just make student-written pieces in our festival. We combine it with published works. Mm-hmm. So it's really nice balance of work.
So can you walk us through what a night of Festival Dionysia would look like?
Yeah, so in the past what we've always done is we pick between 6 and 7 shows, and because they're one act, they're all under 20 minutes. So you see 3 shows, and then it's intermission, and you see another 3 shows. So it's a lot at once. And because of this, we are changing it this year. And so we don't have all the full details for people yet, but it's going to be something similar to Fringe Festival. There's going to be a walking tour of campus, and there'll be at least 7 shows in multiple venues. So there'll be a lot of choices for people to pick from.
What do you consider when you're deciding whose shows will be played? Are you thinking about students? Are you thinking about what's going on in the world? What's on your mind?
For me, it's a lot about what's going on in the world. I would love to be able to create more theater that surrounds more feminist issues. Like, that's my passion. But yeah, anything that really reflects what's going on in the world, we find that a lot. Like, for example, when Disgrace was happening 2 years ago, it was when the same week that Trump was elected into office.
Wow.
And if you know what Disgrace is about, it's a lot about... racial tension and
growing up in America as a minority. Yeah.
And so it was really relevant at the time, and it was really heartbreaking. Definitely. For the two girls who were presidents too, like, they were both American citizens, so we really try to produce work that speaks to us and that reflects what we believe too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But for Dionysia too, there's always a great mix, so mm-hmm. there's lots of comedy, a lot of really funny drama, mm-hmm. so it's a real mixed bag.
Yeah.
Right, so would you say that what you have in mind when you're selecting plays for Dionysia is also what you have in mind when you're selecting their main stage production? Are you also thinking about what's going on in the world, or is that more flash to what's classic?
I think for Dionysia, that's definitely still something that's on our mind, but Dionysia is really student-focused, so when we select directors and actors and playwrights, we really want to make sure that we're selecting a good body of student work mm-hmm. as our first priority, and then we look right. towards published pieces or other options that are out there, which there are a lot of.
Yeah, definitely. What would have been some of your highlights of Dionysia? What do you think really sort of holds the festival together, and what do you think people who watch Dionysia or participate in it get out of it?
I know for actors, their big thing is being able to play with new work, which is just so fun, because when you're an actor and you get to do a lot of classical pieces, it's so amazing, but you know these parts. Everyone's played these parts. But when it's new work, it's new, it's exciting. You get to talk to the writer. They're in rehearsals with you. You get to hear, like, what they were doing when they wrote this part, and everyone's just so lively and so excited to, like, start something new. There's nothing tiresome about it. There's nothing redundant. It's all new and exciting.
Mm-hmm. And you really work from the ground up mm-hmm. because you see it being built and you see it come to life. So it's a really intimate process.
Yes, yeah.
And yeah, and there's also just a huge cast, a huge production team to work mm-hmm. with for Dionysia every year. So you meet a lot of new cool people
yeah.
who sort of share your same interests and bring something new to the table.
Yeah. So Dionysia is kind of reaching out to students all across UBC as well as other campuses who mm-hmm. are interested in theater. What do you think is so important about getting students, university students in particular, actively involved in theater?
I think theater is just an amazing form of expression and mm-hmm. of art, and not a lot of people have access to it. So especially when you're in university and you're sort of locked into a very academic schedule, it becomes really necessary, I think, to have a creative outlet. And so our hope as a club is to be that outlet for people mm-hmm. And to sort of provide a safe place where people can play and create theater.
Yeah, in my biased opinion, I think theater is the best form of expression. I work with children, too, and that's what I'm going to in my line of work. And any chance I get them to use theater, to express what they're thinking, how they feel. And I think we really lose that when we get older. And so I think it's mm-hmm. great to be like, okay, I just wrote this really hard engineering midterm, but I can go and put on a crazy costume and run around stage and express myself.
Yeah. Yes, we've both sort of already answered this, but maybe you could just develop it a little bit more. What do you personally think is so important about theater? And maybe you could consider that question in the context of today, because there's so many other ways of accessing art through television, podcasts, even through reading a book or studying a script in class. What do you think is so valuable about actually sitting in the seat, being with the actors on stage and seeing the action unfold in front of you?
I think you summarized it perfectly. Yeah, nothing beats being in a venue in real time and seeing things unfold in front of you and being able to interact with the people on stage and sort of feel the energy of the room. There's nothing like it.
Yeah.
And it's also just a very, it's a very intimate sort of form of art, and it comes in all forms. Like, I'm really also interested in improv theater, which... like, at its core, it's still theater. It's still people coming together on stage and doing things live in front of live audiences and seeing their reactions.
Yeah. Even with Ghosts, since we have a thrust stage and the audience is sitting on the stage, as you know when you watched it, I don't think you'll get the same feeling as listening or watching something. But when you're there and the actor's standing two, like, feet away from you, and you can feel their body moving, and you can hear their breath, and you feel like you're on the stage with them and you're experiencing that. There's no other feeling in the world of really connecting with someone. You don't know this person. It's some random actor who's just playing a part, but that connection you feel, and even the director's choices and the designer's choices, be able to see that spotlight flip on, or be able to hear like the crickets in the background, or to be able to see the exact way the chair was, you know, put on stage. It's a different feeling when you're in it and you're sitting on stage and you're really... you're embraced and brought into the piece.
Yeah. And there's also just something really special about work that's not permanent. Like, you repeat it every single night. Every night's different.
Different. Very different sometimes.
And there's, that spontaneity that's also just really exciting. And very much so if you're involved. So.
With Doubt for Us, the big part of it is you don't know at the end if the thing, when the main character is accused of, is true or not. So every night, it was played slightly different. So some nights you're like, oh, he did it. And some nights you're like, oh, no, I don't think he did. And it's interesting to see how audiences interpret text, interpret the plot based on what the actor's moods are that day, or how they present their lines, or the way they shifted their body slightly. And it's really cool to see how different audiences react every night to the show, because we're there every night. This is our one night we're skipping, and we both have a little bit of anxiety.
So why do you think that people come to see plays? I guess it kind of picks up on the same, what you were just saying about intimacy. Do you think that that's what's on people's minds, or do you think that students need an escape, or is it maybe for creative inspiration? Who's like your audience when you look at what's the kind of demographic?
It's mostly art students at UBC and our actors' parents. We have a pretty big audience from the theater department, which we always appreciate, and lots of art students who just see our posters around Buchanan and things like that and want to see it. I hear a lot of people looking for creativity, and they're like, oh, I love theater in high school, but I just haven't been to a show in so long, and I wanted some inspiration, which is always awesome that they come to our work to find that.
Mm-hmm. And also, another thing about theater is you're forced to be in a room for 2 hours and not look at your phone, so that's also what draws other people to come, is that they really do want to be present and focused and in a place for like a few hours and just, you know, absorb words and actions on stage. And that's I guess that kind of answers your previous question, which is like, what's different about theater? You have to be focused.
One of my favorites, a lot of my friends aren't into theater and don't really see shows except for mine, but they love it now because it makes them feel so cultured. They say, they're like, oh, I feel so smart, I went to saw a play today. And they love telling all their friends, we went to saw a play.
And your phones are off.
Yeah.
How do you think that with sort of a Bard on the Beach, which is becoming, I think, increasingly popular. I know that this summer, I think it was probably the first summer where they actually extended their play period for a week past the predicted deadline. So that's very popular, and now UBC is doing Much Too About Nothing, which I think Bard did fairly recently. Do you think that there's kind of an increase in interest in theater, or do you think that it's always been very popular but maybe just not discussed?
I think it's really cool that theater has been a dying art for centuries, and it's still going, but I think there has been a little of an increase with the fact that Vancouver's kind of turned to North Hollywood, which is really interesting, and because more and more actors I think, really do believe in the phase that phrase that theater makes you good and film makes you famous. And so they really do like to go back to those roots. And I think it's really great how those numbers are increasing now, that people are not just so focused on film in Vancouver, and they are coming a little bit back by the theater. And our, I think our theater community in Vancouver definitely has a reputation for being very exclusive. But I think it's expanding a little bit. I feel like it's getting a little bit more open, and networking is a little more of an option.
It's just really exciting to see theater grow in Vancouver. I'm not from Vancouver, so when I first came here, it was really exciting to see all the awesome stuff that was being produced.
Will you be on the exec next year? Do you plan to be a part of UBC Players Club next year?
I will be graduating.
Congratulations.
I've been president for 2 years. I've been asked to be president next year again. We shall see if that happens or not. Yeah. But I'll keep a foot in the door. Okay. I'll still be president. We won't abandon the exec team quite yet.
So then I guess as you're stepping away from the club or considering whether or not you'll still be active in it next year, what are your hopes for the way that the club is going to grow in the future?
I really hope for us is Dionysia. I really want Dionysia to expand. I want it to turn like this big thing on campus, not just like another one of our shows. I want it to be like a really big deal and take up a lot of space and be a well-known event. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping we expand a little bit more. If it doesn't just mean expanding our exec team, but expanding how big our shows are, maybe our venues, our reputation, whatever that entails, I would like us to be a little more of a bigger presence, like we used to be back in 1915.
And yeah, we do have a very long history, and I just hope to continue the club, and hopefully that legacy lives on. And yeah, just to echo what Bryn said, Dionysia is a really, really awesome opportunity for people to showcase their work. So I know a lot of creative writing students who don't get the opportunity to see their stuff on stage, and this is a great chance to make that happen.
How do people actually get that to you if there's listeners right now who are interested in participating? Who do they email?
Yes. So first things first, go and like our Facebook page, UBC Players Club. Information's on there. We also have a website, which is ubcplayersclub.com. And all of the information about how to apply and our very strange application process and emails are on there, depending on what position you're applying for.
Oh, if you have questions, you can email info@ubcplayersclub.com.
Are you going to continue with theater after you graduate?
Yeah, I'm in third year. I'm studying theater in school. I'm getting my BA, but I'm becoming a kindergarten teacher. But right now, I'm a fine arts coordinator for an after-school care society. So I do plan on continuing to do theater with kids. And the great thing about being a teacher is you're done at 3 o'clock every day and call time is 5:30. So I do plan on continuing to do theater hopefully till I die. Yeah.
And honestly, this club, the experiences I've had with this club have made me realize that I do want to work in arts. And so, yeah, definitely I'm going to be doing theater once I graduate.
Do you know in what form?
Writing and producing. Yeah.
Writing and producing.
Very exciting.
Do you have any closing thoughts, anything you want to say before the end of the interview?
We'll be opening applications for Dionysia in November, at the end of this month. So just keep a lookout on our Facebook page, and then you can apply. And hopefully we'll see you in the spring.
Great. I'll see you then for sure.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
We all know that the word jazz means many different things to many different people, so check out The Real Deal on The Jazz Show at CITR 101.9 FM or CITR.ca for live streaming. Yours truly, Gavin Walker, is your host, and I guarantee the straight goods of 3 hours of jazz at its finest. So come on by and give your ears a musical workout, 9 p.m. Mondays. Don't miss it.
You've got big things to do. Well, my sweet chickadee, I've got hot news for you. I've got your number. I know you inside out. You ain't no Eagle Scout. You're all at sea. Oh, yes, you brag a lot. Wave your own flag a lot. But you're unsure a lot. You're a lot like me. And I've got your number, and what you're looking for, and what you're looking for just suits me fine. We'll break the rules a lot, we'll be damn fools a lot, but then why should we not? How could we not? Glow you've got. I've got your number, and baby,